So thanks for battling it in through the rain, particularly if you drove down the 401. I don't know. So I'm going to. This is a talk about structure in optimization, but not structure so much in the common way we use the language that you know a priori that a problem that you're given is convex, for example, or smooth or sparse or an STP or something like that. The structure I want to talk about is more geometric. It's a geometric kind of notion, and I'm going to make two arguments about this geometric property, if you like, of feasible regions. So one is going to be that it's useful for optimizers to be aware of, in some sense, either in a concrete way or in a more abstract way. So from a point of view of thinking about optimality conditions or sensitivity analysis or designing algorithms. And secondly, I'm going to argue, so you know, there are lots of properties like that, like the property that a feasible region is a singleton, but I'm also going to argue that this property is common, is a common property. And by common, what I'm going to mean is that for concrete optimization, so non-pathological optimization problems, and I'll sort of explain what I mean by that in a moment, this property will typically be there to be found. So it'll be, and I'll explain what I mean by typically too. Okay, so here an outline is what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to give you my basic framework is going to be composite optimization. So I'm going to give you a composite optimization framework. I'm going to show you how you can think about classical problems of interest and less classical problems of interest in this composite kind of framework. So the exact penalty approach to classical nonlinear programming, a little bit on compressed sensing, low rank matrix completion. We've had at least a couple of talks on these notions already. I'm going to sort of motivate what I want to talk about by a simple general purpose proximal algorithm, again in along somewhat similar lines to some of the earlier talks. And I'm going to think about acceleration, about making that algorithm go faster. This geometric property that I want to talk about, the geometry of what I call partial smoothness, how you might think about using that geometry in particular to think about accelerating algorithms. And then I want to talk about why this is typical. And so here we come to this notion of what I'm going to mean when I say a concrete optimization problem or a non-pathological optimization problem. So I'm going to model that idea in my mind by thinking about feasible regions that are semi-algebraic. So semi-algebraic sets are kind of a rich class. Of course, they don't represent everything you're interested in, but they're a rich, concrete class of sets that avoid lots of the kind of pathologies that actually variational analysts traditionally love to think about. So those all go away when you're thinking about semi-algebraic sets. So semi-algebraic sets are finite unions of sets defined by finitely many polynomial inequalities. And then I'll talk about the sort of generic variational geometry that's going to be of interest in this semi-algebraic setting when we're thinking about partial smoothness. So then if I get time at the end, depending on how far I get, I'll talk a little bit more about how you can use semi-algebraic ideas in variational analysis more generally, and then a sort of whimsical end note at the end, if we have time. Okay, so that's where we're going. So first of all, then, the framework. So to keep things simple, I'm going to sort of talk about the simplest interesting kind of case of this framework. And in this case, H, there's an outer function H. So this is an objective function that I'm trying to minimize over variables X in Rn. I have an outer function H, which is not smooth, but it's everything else is sort of pretty good about it. So it's finite and convex. Okay, so for example, it might be a polyhedral function, a finite polyhedral function. And then there's an inner function C. So this is actually a non-convex optimization problem because there's an inner function C which is just smooth. Okay, so it's neither smooth nor convex, but the way in which it's not smooth is not very bad, and the way it's not convex is not very bad either. Okay. All right, so now the key assumption that I want to make from a computational perspective, if you like, is that this function H here, this outer function H, which is finite and convex, is very simple in some sense. And what do I mean by simple? Well, by simple is going to be context dependent, but something about H makes it relatively easy to solve problems of this form when the inner function is affine. Okay, so you can, so the way that I'm going to think about this is that that kind of a problem is a sort of black box that I can solve quickly. Okay, somehow, quick in some sense. Okay, so for when we make, in particular when we make the linear approximation to C around some current point, and D is going to be the step that you're going to take, so we get this linear approximation C tilde, that this problem, when I add a proximal term here, that subproblem is going to be easy to solve. Okay? So that's the key assumption. So we're going to talk about that, you know, you might talk about this, this is the proximal linearized subproblem of some sort. Okay. Okay, so let's see some examples. So, so okay, let's start with the algorithm first. Actually, that's probably a better idea. So, so the algorithm is very simple. So it's a proximal type of algorithm. Hence this proximal term here. The reason I'm interested in this extra term here. So it's a proximal type of algorithm. What do? It's iterative in the variable x. So you have a current iter at x, and there's some non-convexity floating around here. So we have to handle this proximal parameter in a reasonably sensible way. Now, again, looking back at this sub, these kind of subproblems you're looking at, this prox parameter mu is going to control the size of the step. So the larger mu is, the more you're discouraged from taking a big step. Okay. So how do we deal with it? Well, so there's a current iter at x, there's a prox parameter mu, non-negative. You form the linear approximation to C at your current iterate, and so you get this linear approximation here in terms of the step d. So we know that that's approximately equal to C of x plus d. So there's this linear approximation. And then you find the unique proximal step d, which is going to depend on the current iterate and the value of the prox parameter mu, that solves this proximal linearized subproblem. Okay, so there's the proximal linearized subproblem. And again, we're assuming that that subproblem is easy to solve relatively. And then you do a kind of a trust region sort of thing. Okay, so you look and see what the actual decrease in the function value is. You compare that to the decrease your linear approximation predicted, and if that's not very good, so if the predicted decrease was way better than the actual decrease, that's telling you that this linear approximation is, from the perspective of where you are right now, not a very good approximation. So you then reject that step in the simplest format of this algorithm and make the prox parameter bigger. So for example, multiply it by 2 to make your next try at a step smaller. And otherwise, you accept the step and you halve the value of the prox parameter. So very simple. Okay? Kind of typical kind of trust region sort of scheme. Okay, so that's the algorithm. Okay, so so let's do some examples. So so for example, let's think about the case of classical nonlinear programming. And again, to keep things simple, let's just think about inequality constraints. So we've got C2 inequality constraints here. We know that we can, in a certain sense, replace this constraint problem by an exact penalty function. So for nu bigger than the size of the corresponding Lagrange multiplier, the optimal solution, these two problems are in a certain sense equivalent from the perspective of local minimizers and critical points. So we can think about looking at this problem instead, where this is the plus sign is the error in this constraint, so the positive part. And then we can simply model that in this composite framework by collecting up the various components in my smooth function C, and then having an outer function H, which is this very simple polyhedral function. Okay. And then these proximal linearized subproblems become these rather simple subproblems here, and that's just a quadratic program. It's solvable by a specialized quadratic programming algorithm. Okay, so these subproblems, if we accept that we can do quadratic programming to solve a problem like this, then that's relatively easy to solve. Okay, so that's a sort of an old idea that in various versions goes back a long way. To Yuan, Jim Burke in the mid-80s, Fletcher and his co-authors, Steve Wright. It's sort of it's this kind of idea, although with a different norm here, is what underlies the process for estimating the active set in K-Nitro. Okay, so it's the sort of preliminary step you do to try to estimate the active set, and I'll come back to that idea of active set estimation in what I'm going to say. Okay, that's what happens here. Michael Friedlander and so on. Okay, so that's classical nonlinear programming. We've heard quite a bit about compressed sensing. So again, just to recap, so the various authors, Candes, Donahoe, Tao, and co-authors. So the idea is we're looking for a sparse solution to a linear system. EX is G. We try to solve that by looking for, so we minimize the squared errors and with an L1 regularization term. Okay, so we put in this L1 regularization with a parameter tor. And again, there are kind of analogous ideas, older ideas that from the statistics community, Lasso and Lars. So, and now when you form these proximal linearizations, so the key fact that makes this this kind of approach attractive is that when you form these proximal linearizations, so remember the idea is you linearize the smooth bit but leave the kind of simple polyhedral convex bit alone, and you end up with a proximal linearized subproblem that looks like this, and the key fact about that is it's separable in D. So in the variables D, it just separates into an individual optimization for each scalar variable DI. And so you just need order N operations to do that, where N's the dimension of D. And that's the idea behind this sparser code of Steve Wright. Okay, and again, as we sort of heard and was suggested by in Kim Chuan's talk, a sort of analogous idea for trying to find, and Steve Velasquez's talk too, we're trying to find a low rank solution of a linear system of equations. So heuristically, and then more recently, kind of backed up by probabilistic arguments, one approach to that is a nuclear norm regularized least squares approach. Okay, so you form this, you try to minimize the least squares error in some sense, plus this multiple of the nuclear norm, which is just the sum of the singular values of that matrix. And so what happens in that situation? Well, again, for reasons sort of analogous to those that Kim Chuan was talking about, when you form the analogous problem here, you do one singular value decomposition, and then you can basically, it separates in terms of the diagonal entries of the things that you're looking at. So then you do exactly the same operation, the shrink operator, basically, that you do to solve that problem in conjunction with that one singular value decomposition. And so in a sort of order, the dimension of the matrix cubed, you can solve that problem quickly. Okay. All right. Okay, so a little bit of convergence theory about this very simple algorithm then. So again, just to recap a little bit of basic convex analysis, so a subgradient, so V is a subgradient of this convex function H at U. That just means that step zero minimizes this this function perturbed by a linear term with gradient V. And then, so the basic optimality condition says that minimizes, and again, because H is convex and finite, we don't need any regularity, basically. So any minimizer for this composite function is critical in the sense that there is a Lagrange multiplier. You can think of it as Y. So Y is just a subgradient of this outer function H at the point CX bar, which also lies in the null space of the Jacobian. So that's the first order optimality condition. And then the sort of key sort of simple theoretical result that kind of drives the analysis is a sort of Lipschitzness property that says that the proximal step that you take when you solve that proximal linearized subproblem is nice, the size of that step is nicely boundable in terms of how far you are away from the critical point. Okay. And so this is joint work with Steve Wright, using that simple tool. And in considerably more general context, non-convex context, and sort of possibly infinite value context, which again ties into what Kim Chuan was talking about, any limit point, so the very simplest global convergence result you could think of, any limit point of this algorithm is going to be a critical point. Okay, so it's a very basic convergence theory, if you like. Okay. All right, so what's it like? Well, so it's this algorithm is, you know, very simple to describe, sort of intuitive, simple. It's versatile. You can apply it to huge problems. So it's nice from those perspectives. But we also know it's very slow. And we know that, well, there are two reasons of, you know, thinking about it theoretically. We know immediately it's going to be slow. So one is the two sort of extreme cases. So if you take the outer function h to be the identity, so you're just minimizing a C2 function, then you're just doing steepest descent with a truss region approach to the step size. And you know that that's, you know, steepest descent is bad, truss region or not. So that's it's going to be slow for ill-conditioned functions. You're going to get linear convergence, but it's going to be slow linear convergence. And then the other sort of extreme cases where the inner function is the identity, and then you're just doing the classical proximal point algorithm with a suitable step size scheme again, and Rockefeller's original theory gives you the linear convergence right there, and again it's going to be slow when the convex function is ill-conditioned in some sense. It's nice in some situations, but typically not. Because again, linear convergence but slow. Okay, so now that, you know, those previous authors I was talking about were not doing such a simple-minded kind of thing. They were using that subproblem to do a subsequent thing, as happens in K-nitro. So in particular, they try to use that initial step to predict what the active constraints are and then to accelerate. And so in some sense, what I want to talk about here is the sort of intrinsic geometry behind that kind of an idea of trying to predict activity, if you like, what it means, what that means. And so the idea is to sort of somehow predict activity and then use a second order model to get you going faster, Newton type scheme. Okay, any questions so far? All right. Okay, so what's the geometry underlying this sort of prediction? So this is the sort of probably the most kind of technical thing that I'm going to put up. So, and this is the underlying geometry that I'm going to claim is sort of central to active set kind of ideas. So what do I want to assume? So I want to assume, first of all, I want to have a non-degeneracy kind of condition. So I want to assume that this Lagrange multiplier y, at the optimal solution, so I'm going to be at a critical point x bar, so there is a Lagrange multiplier, and I want to assume not only is this Lagrange multiplier a subgradient, but it's actually in the relative interior of the set of subgradients. Okay, so that's kind of a strict complementarity sort of a condition, and it also sits in the null space of the Jacobian, of course, right? So we know that. Okay, so then I'm going to say that this function h, that the outer, so by the way, I should say from now on in, again to simplify, I'm going to think about, from a geometric perspective, I'm going to think about the case where the inner function C is just the identity. Okay, so I'm just thinking about the geometry of this convex function H. Okay, so I'm going to say this function H is partly smooth relative to some manifold in its domain. So what's a manifold? Just a smooth surface. So a set of solutions of some smooth equations with linear independent gradients at the point. So we've got this active manifold around my point C of X bar. If the following properties hold, so first of all, on this manifold, which is a surface in the domain of H, okay, in the domain space of H, so H is smooth when you restrict it to that surface. And secondly, when you think about the set of subgradients, so the subdifferential, it has a nice, so it has two nice things going on about it. So one is it's varying in a nice continuous way, restricted to the manifold. So as you come off the manifold, all kinds of stuff can happen. But if you move around on this manifold, this set of subgradients varies in a continuous way in some kind of set notion. Okay, so there's a set of subgradients and it's varying in a continuous way. Okay, and furthermore, it's orthogonal to it. So it's big enough, so first of all, it's big enough to capture the whole normal space to this manifold, and it's actually orthogonal. Okay, the orthogonality, in fact, just comes from the optimality condition. The key thing is it's big enough. Okay, it's a big enough set. Okay, and that corresponds to a kind of a sharpness condition of this function h around this ridge. So as you move around on this ridge, the function h is smooth. As you move, if you like, orthogonal to it, you get this kind of V-shaped behavior. So you get this sharp behavior. So this is this conjunction of two nice things going on. And I'm going to argue that that's the sort of key to driving active set ideas. Okay, so what's a good example? A good example is just take the distance function to a polyhedron, and then that function is partly smooth around any point relative to the open facet that point sits in. Okay, so that's the manifold. Okay. All right, so that's the sort of thing to try to absorb and have in core memory, if you like. Okay. All right, so now, why is that nice from an active set perspective? So actually, this property is nice from all kinds of perspectives, so some of which I'm not going to talk about, but it's going to be good from a point of view of sensitivity analysis. M basically captures what happens under perturbation. It's good from a point of view of writing down second-order optimality conditions. I may actually have that here in a moment. But the key that I want to talk about here is it's good from a point of view of identification, so trying to identify activity. And why is that? Well, assuming this non-degeneracy and this sort of geometric structure, so non-degeneracy and partial smoothness, for this particular algorithm, and actually for lots of other algorithms too, so if this proximal algorithm generates points converging to X-bar, which we know the kind of first order scheme will do under reasonable conditions, and it generates steps dr, then eventually it identifies this manifold M in the following sense, that the point predicted by the linear model actually lies on the set M, so it hits that set M. Okay, so that's sort of what I mean by identification. It kind of lands. So if you were looking at a polyhedral function, you'd be kind of picking up the activity somehow. Okay. And so the idea, again, the sort of meta idea would be that if this function H is reasonably simple, like a polyhedral, for example, this whole set of subgradients is computable, and we know it's orthogonal to the manifold M at this point CR, this predicted point CR, and so if you're following this algorithm along, you basically track M, and then the idea would be to somehow use second-order properties of C and the smooth function H restricted to M to try to accelerate. So you've captured, if you like, the tangent space to this manifold via this subdifferential, and you know the function H is smooth as you move along this manifold, so you can do a kind of constrained Newton scheme. That would be, broadly speaking, the idea. Okay, and that's the sort of idea of, again, some earlier authors, and in particular Bob Mifflin and Claudius Agastizabal in some version. Right, so that's a good question, and it turns out the answer to that question is no, there can't be. In fact, one can show that the M is unique, so there is at most one M that does that. Okay, so like the polyhedral case, for example, there's a unique open facet that a point sits in. So but it's not obvious, but it is actually true that there is that if this M exists, it's unique. Okay, locally, so locally around the point. Okay. All right, so actually I do have a sensitivity result here. So so this is another way in which it's nice to know about this property, because it gives you a handle on second order conditions, perhaps not surprisingly. So here's a theorem. So assuming a kind of a transversality condition, so again that sort of corresponds to linear independence of the active constraints in some sense. That's what's going on here. And assuming a second-order growth condition, so the function H grows quadratically on this active manifold M around the point X bar. And again, remember it looks kind of complicated because H is not smooth, but H is smooth on M, right? And so one can write that down in using smooth classical language, and you get a smooth second-order condition for this for local minimality. Okay, and furthermore, there's a unique local minimizer, so you get local minimality under these conditions. So there's sufficient conditions for local minimality and nice sensitivity. So in the easiest sensitivity kind of analysis, you're just making a linear perturbation. There's a unique local minimizer near X bar, and it lies on the inverse image of this manifold under C. So you capture exactly what's happening to local minimizers nearby. And furthermore, it depends smoothly on the data vector V. Okay, yeah, Mike. So yeah, in a concrete, so if you wanted to follow that scheme I was talking about before, I'm just saying that if you could do that, then you would be able, yeah, so I'm not making a bolder claim than that, because obviously that's a strong claim. It's not something that, you know, bundle method type people would like to assume. So typically you don't want to assume that you've got the whole sub-differential at your disposal. But, you know, for example, if you're talking about something very simple like a norm, then, you know, it's easy to do. So like a polyhedral. polyhedral norm of some sort. Okay, so it's a sufficient condition to be able to do this rather than... Okay. All right, so that's the argument that this is a nice property to have, I guess. So it'd be nice if you were either it's a nice thing to be aware of because it's capturing sensitivity, and it's a nice thing to be able to really capture in a concrete way if you're trying to design an algorithm. So now the second question is, are these reasonable assumptions? So whenever you make assumptions about this, and so for example, King Chuan had constraint non-degeneracy. We should ask ourselves, well, is that a reasonable assumption, right? I mean, you know, when we look at our problems, is that going to be an assumption that's going to hold? And I didn't get to ask, but I'll ask you later. So is that a reasonable assumption? So how typically is that going to hold? So how typical are these assumptions? Non-degeneracy, this geometric assumption of partial smoothness, and this quadratic growth condition. And again, so for simplicity, I'm going to fix the inner function C to be the identity. Okay, and I want to ask these questions. So again, this sort of style of questioning about when as regularity conditions about optimization problems are sensible has a long history. So here are some. So in nonlinear programming, Spingarn and Rockefeller. So they asked the question: well, when is strict complementarity and primal dual non-degeneracy a kind of a generic condition in some sense? So when can we assume that that holds for generic data? So they show it's true in some sense for nonlinear programming. Actually, it's an older, it was looked at longer ago for complementarity problems. Semi-definite programming, Ali Zeta, Haberle, and Overton, and Alex Shapiro. And more generally, for conic convex programs, Levent and Gabor looked at this problem in the early part of the century, showing in all cases, showing in some sense that some version of strict complementarity and primal dual non-degeneracy is in some sense a generic property. So in our setting, H is just a very simple convex function. What are we trying to do? So given a data vector V, we're really trying to minimize this. In other words, we're really trying to compute the functional conjugate. So there are a couple of very classical theorems, that are relevant. So Mazur's theorem says that if you've got a convex coercive function H, so grows faster than linearly, then for a generic vector V, generic means, he meant it in a topological sense on a density delta, the optimal solution is unique. So there's a unique optimal solution. That really has to do with differentiability of convex functions, basically. So that's what it's differentiability of the functional conjugate. So it's generically differentiable. So we have that property. Basically as a consequence of Saad's theorem, for a C2 function H, now non-convex, so just a C2 function H, then in a measure theoretic sense, for almost all V, quadratic growth holds around every local minimizer. So for almost every data vector V, if you look at every local minimizer of that problem, you get quadratic growth. Okay, so that's Saad's theorem, a consequence of Saad's theorem. So those are kind of examples of ways in which you can answer this kind of question. Okay, now, again, these are sort of structural, so we're making sort of assumptions about the underlying structure of the problem here. So, and what I want to do is sort of make this more geometric, if you like. So let's now think about the situation where all I know about the graph of H is that it's semi-algebraic. So it's, if you like, so graph or epigraph, if you like, either way is fine. So it has some representation as a finite union of sets defined by finitely many polynomial inequalities. But I don't know that representation. I just know that it has that nice property. And that's very often we're in that situation of knowing that a set's semi-algebraic for kind of existential reasons without having the representation. And the reason for that, the fundamental reason for that is that when you project such sets, that property is preserved. Okay, so under some kind of complicated sequence of projections, we end up with this new set from the one that we started with. We know it's semi-algebraic because that property is preserved under projections. Okay, so the approach that I'm going to describe then is independent of the presentation here. So I'm not going to rely on the presentation of the set. I'm just going to rely on nice properties of semi-algebraic sets. Okay, so here's this is the Tarski-Seidenberg theorem, what I just mentioned, that we can recognize semi-algebraicity via quantifier elimination. So that's the sort of algebraic way of thinking about the fact that the projection of a semi-algebraic set is semi-algebraic. The other nice thing about semi-algebraic sets, the semi-algebraic world, is that when we're thinking about generic properties, and we normally have to worry exactly what generic means. What does it mean with, you know, with probability one, like full measure, or does it mean on density delta, or what does it mean? Well, everything sort of collapses in the semi-algebraic world. So we're just going to talk about, so generic is just the same as dense, okay, for subsets of a convex set. So, yes, Kurt. Extremely bad, right? So, and that's exactly the reason why I would like to think about properties that I can deduce from the existential knowledge that a set semi-algebraic without actually having a representation. Exactly. Yeah. So it's doubly exponential in the dimensions of the things.
So if you know it can come that way, wouldn't you formulate the polynomial with the test variables and have a semi-algebraic thing in a large dimension where you only care about the
numbers? When you say wouldn't. Would for what? Right, but for what purpose would you do that?
If you had an algorithm that took advantage of the semi-algebraic things, but you didn't want to do it in low dimensions, you could just do it in high.
Maybe, I don't know. Yeah, right. Yeah, maybe. I don't. Yeah. Okay. All right. So here's a kind of a purely sort of geometric kind of reason why one sees partial smoothness, okay, typically. Okay, so again, my argument is going to be, okay, so a good model for non-pathological sets is semi-algebraic sets. Okay, so that's a rich class, not necessarily convex, not necessarily smooth, rich class of convex sets closed under lots of kind of mathematical operations that you see. So those are going to be my concrete sets. I'm going to restrict attention to the convex case, and I'm going to ask, well, now let's think about sort of generic convex minimization. So let's think about perturbing by a generic data vector V, minimizing that function H. Okay. So then the theorem says that for a generic data vector V, which in this setting just means on a dense open subset of Rn, it's a really kind of simple reason. Then, so a dense open subset actually of the domain, where the optimal value is finite, everything good happens. So you get constraint non-degeneracy, partial smoothness, so this nice geometric property, kind of ridge property around the epigraph of H, relative to some unique manifold. So there's a unique manifold around which that's true. You get quadratic growth on that manifold, and you get this nice sensitivity property as a consequence, essentially. That the optimal solution depends smoothly and varies smoothly on this manifold M as you vary the data vector V. Yeah, Rob.
So the quadratic growth is local?
Yeah, it's local. Although, you know, if you're thinking about compact sets, for example, local is the same as global. So to. Right. Right. So yeah. So with a compactness, So if you've got if you're looking at things over a compact set, for example, then you know it's enough. Then, yeah. But you're right. I mean, to actually have global quadratic growth, you'd need something more. Okay. So that's the sort of gist of what I wanted to say along these lines. So now. But now I want to follow up a little bit. So what I've tried to show here is this assumption about my function H being concrete in a certain sense has a nice consequence for a nice variational analysis kind of consequence. And I want to give you a couple more examples of that kind of theme because that's sort of what I like to do. So as I said, variational analysts like to think about pathological examples. And a lot of the contortions that we go through when we do variational analysis are basically designed to rule those out. So a sort of property that I've assumed that I've sort of followed for several years now is the fact that when you assume that the things that you're looking at are semi-algebraic, those problems vanish. Basically, everything gets nice. Okay, so here's an absolutely fundamental example, which everybody should know about, even whether they're variation analysts or not. So, and it looks, again, slightly complicated, but again, I sort of beg your attention to this because I really think it's a fundamental property. So this is the property of metric regularity of a set-valued mapping F. Okay, so we're thinking about set-valued mapping, so they take a point in Rn and map it to a set in Rm. So why are we interested in set-valued mappings? Well, because we're optimizers and we're interested in inequalities rather than equations. Okay, so and you can use it to model systems of inequalities. Okay, so this set-valued mapping is metrically regular at some solution x bar to a kind of a generalized equation for some data vector y bar. So you could think of that about that as a set of inequalities. If the following local error bound holds, so this is a sort of fundamental kind of core idea in theoretical numerical analysis, that when you make small perturbations, so you take a new data vector y, and then you're interested in trying to find a solution for that, you've got some putative solution x, you'd like to know, well, how far away is x from this solution set f inverse of y? And again, the thing to keep in mind here is that if I give you x, you can compute f of x easily. So you have it's a polyhedron depending on x. But if I give you y, it's hard to compute f inverse of y. Okay, so that's the sort of model. Okay, so what you'd like to know is how far are you away, is a putative solution away from the actual solution set? And metric regularity is the property that thing that you'd like to know is bounded by a multiple of the a posteriori error. So if I actually give you a solution, say, is this really a solution? You plug it in, compute f of x, and see how far y is away from that. And so you hopefully can compute this easily. And if you can bound, so if there's a linear bound for this distance you actually want to know in terms of the a posteriori error, then locally, so around this point x bar, y bar, then that's called metric regularity. Okay, so that's the key idea. All right, so for example, for a smooth function f, it's surjectivity of the Jacobian. That's what that property is. Okay. All right, so, and if that property doesn't hold, then you call the data vector y bar. So if that property doesn't hold for some x bar, you call the corresponding data vector critical. Okay. So one way to state Saad's theorem is that if you've got a vector-valued function, smooth function f, then such functions have almost no critical values in a measure theoretic sense. So for almost no right-hand side, will this property fail? Okay. All right, so now here's a sort of very special case of, just because I wanted to get my name in there, but the theorem that you should look at is this theorem at the bottom, which is due to Alex Joffe, which again, I think everybody should know because it's a beautiful and very simple theorem. And that says that if you take any semi-algebraic set-valued mapping F, the set of non-critical values is generic. Okay, so if you have any kind of semi-algebraic set-valued system for a generic data vector, you'll have this nice metric regularity property, which I think is really kind of a simple, striking, beautiful result. Is that a question? No. So yeah, well, I mean, this is a measure of conditioning, if you like, local conditioning. So as a sort of general philosophy, I think it's a fascinating question to try to tie this quantity, in particular this linear bound, the infimum of a linear bound that you get here, there is a beautiful result due to Donchev, Lewis, and Rockefeller that says that quantity, the infimum of the linear constants, is the distance, the size of the smallest perturbation that you can make to destroy that property. So it is related to a distance to ill conditioning, if you like. And so one would expect then that it's closely tied to behavior of algorithms. Although to actually do that, you have to look at each algorithm in turn and think about how it's related. But I'm not sure about Gaussian elimination, but for example, if you do conjugate gradients, then it is related exactly to that. The linear convergence of conjugate gradients, things like that. Yeah. Okay, so another example which I kind of like. So a basic property of a smooth function f is that the gradient mapping has, its graph has dimension n everywhere. So it's an n-dimensional kind of surface. And there's a nice theorem of Minty that says that there's a nice analog for convex functions. So if you look at the graph of the subdifferential of a convex function, it has dimension n everywhere. It's actually kind of quite a striking fact. So this, you know, of course, the subdifferential is set-valued, right? So you look at its graph, but if you look at its graph, it's actually an n-dimensional Lipschitz manifold around every point. And so if you want to actually solve equations on that graph, then there are nice consequences of that fact. So if you've got, you know, you're trying to solve some equations with a side variational condition, talking about something being a subgradient, then that's a nice consequence. So you can talk about subgradients for more continuous functions, for continuous functions. So here you basically just relax by a small order term. So it's again, it's basically saying that zero minimizes what happens when you perturb by a linear function with gradient to subgradient, but you're allowed a small order error. Okay, and that then you get a sort of a non-convex version of the subdifferential, and typically I'll say what I mean by typically in a moment. So typically the graph of the subdifferential of a non-convex function is big. It's actually 2n dimensional. And you can make that precise in the following sense, that if you take a typical function in the set of all functions of Lipschitz constant 1, then the graph of the subdifferential is 2n dimensional. Okay. And now typical means in some topological sense, generic in that sense. So typical functions in this sense are very bad. But on the other hand, if you think about semi-algebraic functions, then again, the graph is everywhere n-dimensional. So again, it's sort of nice. So semi-algebraic functions rule out those kind of pathologies of having big subgradients, big sets of subgradients. Okay, so we do have time for a little bit of whimsy at the end of this. Let me back up a second. So this is an embarrassing thing when you're a kind of theoretical non-smooth optimizer like me, and so you talk about these things that you're kind of proud of, and then people in the audience come up to you and say, "Well, I've got this great non-smooth optimization problem. What do I do to solve it?" And so then you sort of get kind of embarrassed, and you sort of say, "Well, you know, there's not so much out there really. It's a kind of general purpose stuff." And then they press you a bit more and say, "What do you mean not so much?" And then you sort of say, "Well, nothing." So that's embarrassing, right? Now that you know, there are non-convex kind of bundle schemes due to people like Keywheel, but they're kind of hard to get to work, you know, and they're not all that readily available, so it's tricky. It's hard. So here is a general purpose scheme. So, and that is that you basically solve these problems using BFGS. So, this is actually not a really new idea. So it's been observed for a long time that often, if you kind of accidentally apply BFGS to a non-smooth function, often it seems to work. And this is an observation actually that goes back to Le Maréchal, probably 40 years. So I just want to talk just a little bit about this. So BFGS, everybody in the room probably knows what BFGS is. So it's designed for minimizing a smooth function f. You have a current iterate x and some positive definite matrix that you conceptually think of as approximating the inverse Hessian. And then you compute what would be the Newton direction if it really was the inverse Hessian, and you take a step in that direction. And you choose the step by a line search, and for example, you can do it by a kind of simple doubling and bisection line search, providing you weaken the standard Wolf conditions to make the second Wolf condition one-sided. So this first condition is a little bit like that kind of truss region-y sort of condition that we looked at before. So this is the Armia condition. It just says that the step you take should see a reasonable decrease within a factor of, let's say, a third, compared with the linear prediction of the function restricted to the line. So there's the Armia condition. The second condition usually requires you to make the derivative at the current point small in absolute value compared with the derivative that you start with. So in fact, the theory doesn't need that. At least the theory for BFGS doesn't need that. It just needs you to go far enough. So you can be sort of big in the other direction, but so you need to stop yourself taking too small a step, but it doesn't matter if you go further. Okay. And actually, weakening in that way has another advantage, that it makes the corresponding line search much easier. So it's much easier to design a line search to to satisfy these conditions than the strong wolf condition, which is kind of a mess if you've ever tried to teach it. It's quite tricky. Okay, and then you update H in the famous kind of rank two way, and you repeat. So, okay. So this is a very popular scheme. Okay, so in practice, it's often a kind of default scheme. The theory is not that great for what we know about it. So in theory, we know that it converges for a convex coercive function f. But even if the function is non-convex c infinity, it can fail. Okay, in principle. So, and that's been relatively well known for a long time. And then there's this observation that it actually works surprisingly well for non-smooth functions f. And this, again, dates back to Le Marachal. Go ahead. So if it's non-smooth, I'll talk about that in a second. But basically, you never hit a point where it's non-smooth. So if you start with a random initial point and kind of randomize H, you never hit a point where it's not smooth. So you don't have to worry. Okay.
So there's some relatively recent work on small examples.
Counterexamples. That's right. Yeah. Macarenus. And. So why is this? Well, why C infinity? So it can't fail for analytic functions, right? I think that's known. I'm not absolutely sure, but I think it's known. But the whole point about C infinity functions is you can kind of locally distort them to do what you need to do, okay, without changing the function in other places. Okay, so you sort of tweak the function locally as you go around and generate a kind of cycle. Okay, so here's just some examples from a recent paper with Mike Overton. So this is a pretty simple non-smooth function. There's a weight term here, just so we can see how what happens here depends on the weight. It's non-smooth. It's got this kind of curving ridge around y equals it. So it's a kind of a Rosenbrocky kind of thing. And then there's another term here just to make the local minimizer unique. So what I've plotted here is so it looks a little odd because you see these jumps up every now and then. So what's going on here? Because it should be monotone. So what's plotted there is every function evaluation, including in the line search. Okay. So this wouldn't be very interesting. So what seems to be happening here is linear convergence. But linear convergence with respect to what? Linear convergence with respect to the number of function evaluations. Okay. So if you were really having to do a huge amount of work in the line searches, then that would be less interesting. And so what we plotted here is every function evaluation that you make. And what it seems to be linear convergence, right? So it seems to be converging linearly. Why? I have no idea. It's trying to approximate the Hessian of a function that doesn't have a Hessian. So what's going on? And what's happened? That Hessian approximation is sort of telling you interesting information at the end. It's giving you actually information about this ridge, this curving ridge. So it's giving you tangent information about that. So you get very large eigenvalues, or very small, whichever way round it is, corresponding to the eigenvectors in those directions, actually the orthogonal directions. But no idea why. But if you've got small, non-smooth problems, here's the conjecture. Suppose we've got a reasonably non-pathological function, for example, semi-algebraic, Lipschitz. You take a random initial point and a random initial Hessian. You randomize, and then you run this algorithm, then the conjecture is the function values converge linearly, and at any limit point is Clark stationary. So there are small convex combinations of nearby gradients. Okay. So it's a good kind of quick answer to the embarrassing question. Well, you can try this. We don't know. We have no idea why it's any good, but it seems to work often. So. Okay. There's the summary. So there's this quick proximal algorithm, this joint work with Steve Wright for composite optimization. Partial smoothness, this geometric idea, is a conceptual tool to think about sensitivity analysis, optimality conditions, acceleration. using semi-algebraic conditions to make generic, to think about generic properties in optimization, and then the FGS. Thank you very much.